You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
Hello and welcome back to the second in our short series looking back at the second RTD era of Doctor Who. Last time we looked at the three David Tennant 14th Doctor specials, and this time I'm joined by Mark again to go through the first half of season one of the 15th Doctor's era, and we're also going to look at the church on Ruby Road before we get into the season as well. Should we jump right in and start off with the church on Ruby Road? So this was our introduction to the 15th Doctor, although we'd seen him in the previous episode in The Giggle. What were your impressions of this when you watched it first?
Really enjoyed it. It is not my favourite of the two Inshuti specials we've had so far, the Christmas specials. Joy to the World ended up being my all-time favourite Christmas special, but we'll talk about that when we get there. But this thing was, I find it very moving. I thought it was a great showcase for... Because, you know, although as much as Inshuti got a significant part in and really shone in his sort of final, you know, what does he appear in there? The final 15 minutes of the last Tennant special there. This was really him, I guess, just appearing without ceremony. There he is, you know, Ruby first sees him at the club dancing and everything. And... you know, it's very much just the Doctor back to, you know, he's post-therapy, but any viewer starting there wouldn't know that. They just see this freewheeling guy. He takes things as he finds them. He's a pure soul. He's an adventurer. And he's kind, you know, and all these qualities come pouring out of him through the whole thing. I think I think as a showcase for Inshuti as the new lead, I think it served him very well. I think the bond with Ruby is there straight away. You know, you see how well they work together as a team. There's great chemistry there, in my opinion. The storyline with the goblins and so on, it's fun, you know, and it's it's also an excuse to do sort of really just crazy stuff, including song and dance in the middle of it. But the real emotional heart of the thing for me lies in a lot of the time. It's amazing how much of it takes place within the stillness of that flat, actually, at times. But it just allows the thing to breathe. I love it when a Doctor Who episode, a regular episode or a special, just is allowed time to really breathe and let those emotional beats play out. And there's moments in that where the Doctor is talking about his recent... discovery of having been adopted and being able to relate to these adopted kids, and when history is set on the wrong track because of the goblin's interference, we get the first of many, you know, tears from Inshuti. And I know some people sort of have rolled their eyes at how much he cries. It's sort of in every episode, really. But I think what that is he processes. Because he is the post-therapy Doctor, he's learned to have healthy, you know, in real-time processing of things that hit him you know, hit him hard or that have real significance to him. So yeah, and you know, it obviously introduces quite a few significant elements going forward. We've got Mrs. Flood, we've got Cherry, and I'm so sorry, her name's gone out of my head. Ruby's adoptive mother, and so that whole setup's there. There's a bit of mystery being seeded in. There's proper Christmassy vibes at the end. We get the total campery of a Christmas tree nearly falling on Davina McCall. Viewers in America probably shrugging at that one. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. By the time we get there, hopefully they've had enough fun with the thing not to be too confused, and they can understand it's a celebrity known over here. Yeah, no, it left a good impression on me, and a great start for the Doctor and Ruby.
Yeah, and like you picked up on one of the bits I thought was interesting, which like we talked about with Wild Blue Yonder, the way that RTD is picking up the timeless child thing and actually building on it and like making it really rooted in like real relatable emotional situations like adoption. And that's really interesting because I think that's where Chris Chibnall's interest in it might have come from originally, but it almost gets expressed. I don't know if I'm misremembering or if I remember him talking about, you know, his own, you know, personal experiences in interviews, but it feels like it's only in this era that it's actually made explicit that connection, or is brought to the fore a bit more.
Yeah, no, he definitely did talk of that, his own adoption experience and wanting, you know, to write a storyline around that. And yet, you're right, I think RTD has given it the most weight, you know, or I think has sort of teased the most out of that in terms of just showing that the emotional effects of that rather than just sort of stating it as a narrative fact. I think that's what Chibnall was going for, but he didn't necessarily hit all the right beats there. It was laudable intent, but maybe not as well executed as what RTD has later layered onto it. So anyway.
And there was some of that in flux with like meeting Tek Tayoun and all of that, but it's kind of, there's so much going on in flux that any sort of that there is something there, but it's a little bit lost. Whereas in this, like you said, these quiet scenes that have room to breathe in the church in Ruby Road, it's just really laid out there in a really sort of nice, simple, effective way. I thought this was interesting because this episode has a lot in common structurally with like going right back to 2005 with Rose, you know, meeting the family, taking the companion's point of view, discovering the Doctor through their eyes. But then I also thought, like, on top of that, you've got these elements brought in that seem like a bit of a mission statement about what this new era is going to be like. I think the music felt like a big part of that, the spectacle and the effects with the goblins. So yeah, it felt like a really good like pilot or sort of mission statement for what this new era is going to be. Like yourself, I haven't watched it in the last few days or weeks, but I felt very positive about it at the time, and I think I still feel the same. The music didn't bother me. It's interesting because I think maybe we can talk about like the theories we had at the time, like mid-season, about where this was all going, but maybe we can talk a bit about the inclusion of music and fourth wall breaks and things as we get into some of the other episodes. But one bit that didn't do so well on a rewatch for me, if I'm honest, is like the sort of setting up the mystery of Ruby's mother and that big, like, all the sort of ponderous, mysterious moments where you see this hooded figure walking away. And I get that that's the point, that it's like this mystery built up around something that is quite ordinary. But yeah, it felt like a bit, like it was built up too much. And again, I realize that's kind of the point, but it's, yeah, that sort of felt a bit flat for me.
It was interesting to hear Russell T. Davis himself on the commentary for that one sit there and go kind of laugh along with, you know, laugh in recognition of the fact that it was a bit overdone and kind of say, why is Ruby's mother wearing this ornate cloak? You know, like he's the one pointing these things out. Maybe he's the one also that she could have stepped in and said, could we, you know, but then what, yeah, I think his point is we wouldn't have done it any other way because it just, we sort of painted ourselves into that corner, so we ran with it. But
that's it.
I'll forgive that a lot, just in terms of the atmosphere that it creates, because you know all that stuff—the carol, of the bells, and you know the snow—and it's so beautifully visually and orally done that I guess those slight illogicalities of presentation, there's a sort of, I don't know, you can meet it halfway on that one, but I do know what you mean. It's a bit, yeah, it doesn't particularly stand up to robust analysis as far as why somebody would look that way in, you know, whatever year, whatever recent year that was supposed to be. I forget what year they said it was, but I'd have to work it out backwards from Ruby's age, but relatively recent times, and somebody dressed like I don't know, something from Victorian.
It didn't bother me at the time before we knew what the reveal was, but it's just like it's rewatching it that it didn't work quite as well for me.
One thing, when it isn't, because it did come back into my head there. I think this is the one where we're both going to be a bit. equally woolly on, just because neither of us appears to have got to a rewatch of this one in very recent days, but the stuff with the mathematics of the language of rope and all that stuff, I loved all that because it's another bit of signaling that they, you know, and we also have like this floating wooden ship. It's like, okay, since the salt incident happened, something more supernatural has crept into the universe. Things that might have looked a little less, things that might have been just outside the line before of what Doctor Who feels it can plausibly present, has, we've moved that line basically. but it allows for some really interesting things. And I mean, I love the fact that the Doctor can sort of understand the language of rope and make all these, and was that there before or after the soul change? I don't know. Maybe there was always that kind of phenomenon in the universe, but it's interesting what's being toyed with there. And I think Russell T. Davis he goes on to sort of finesse that a bit more as series one.
And that's set up in World Beyonder. It's that the whole idea is it's this discrete change. The Doctor does something and it releases all these magical forces, but kind of out of universe, looking at Doctor Who as a whole, if you draw a line from, is it the demons, the one where like the third Doctor is you know, talking about superstition and science and appropriately enough, that story is about a demon and sort of effectively supernatural being, but is actually an alien, which is like a recurring thing in Doctor Who. But then I feel like over the decades, you know, you get to Battlefield towards the end of the original run, and then you get into like The Impossible Planet and a lot of stories in the new run and the books that came between. I feel like Doctor Who has gotten increasingly magical and sort of blurring the lines between science and magic as the years have gone on, from taking this very sort of skeptical scientific position of it can all be explained to now sort of saying, yeah, like there is magic.
There's just weird stuff that seeps in through the cracks, and it's all just part of an expanded kind of realm of possibility. And sometimes it's going to feel like a sciencey one, and sometimes it's going to feel like, okay, you know, the normal rules of physics may not quite apply on this one, but it has its own freewheeling kind of fantasy fun to it. So let's just lean into that. I think we have that more than ever this season, and I'm not saying that critically, because I know a lot of people, well, it seems to have been a very Marmite experience, that kind of tonal change, but I personally am on the side of just, you know, it's what we have for the time being, let's enjoy it, and there's a lot to be said for it. It's brought new possibilities to the table, and some of them have been done very well.
Yeah. And maybe in our next episode we can talk about looking forward to season two, because it feels like it's going to be sort of even more leaning into the whole gods and magic side of things. But should we go on to Space Babies, which is an interesting one, because it, like, rewatching this, Space Babies, it's not bad, but it feels like a bit of an aberration, because we've got Wild Blue Yonder, the toy maker, you know, goblins, and then the next episode we have Maestro, and in the middle we have this story that feels like a sort of throwback to the original RTD run in terms of like tone and what's going on. And like I said, it's not a bad story, but for me it's by far the weakest. And it's, I think we felt this, we talked about this at the time, that it's like, it feels like a weird choice to start off the season. But what were your thoughts? Did you get a chance to rewatch Space Babies?
Yes, I did. I have to say, very similar thoughts to your own on that. I would accept, you know, I would agree with you, and I think the majority would take this view that it is the weakest of the that first Tinchuti series. I'm aware that many people out there absolutely detest it. I am not one of those people. I actually find it, you know, it's fun. It's in places. It's Do you know what the only real problem I have with it is? It's a little bit try hard. You know, like, it's got that that energy where you're being slight. You know, sometimes lots of pace and energy works, and other times it just feels like, okay, stay with us. This is going to be an exciting show. You know, lots is going to be happening. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be wacky. The doctor's going to say, you know, things that are really quick fire way for you. And I don't know, it feels a bit like that. And it's an odd one. There's moments in it that I really like. I love that first sequence of just Ruby walking in slow motion into the TARDIS. There's beautiful music, but that's of course a bit of a holdover from the church in Ruby Road. I know one of the things that gets criticized quite heavily is that the doctor is, like, there's literally a scene where a series of questions and answers is more or less dealt with in short succession. The doctor says, oh, well, let me tell you about myself. I'm a Time Lord and da-da-da. Now, some people, I've heard quite a few people say that they find that really clunky. I personally don't, and I think some considerable thought and care has gone into just saying, no, that's what, you know, first of all, it is helpful for new viewers, but it's not, I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that those would be the, you know, that would be the, there's even a moment where Ruby has to catch up on stuff the doctor had told her 10 minutes ago, and she says, wait a minute, genocide? What? Like, you know, she's acknowledging the fact that there's a lot to take in, but to ignore the fact that there's a lot to take in would also be a bit, I don't know, strange. So I think RTD has in interviews and things robustly defended, and I think rightly defended, that kind of sort of, you know, let's just have the conversation. For we may know all this stuff, but Ruby doesn't, and some brand new viewer may not, and it's still interesting to hear it put, even stuff we've heard 100 times before from the doctor, it's interesting to hear how this doctor puts it this time. And so, you know, that's all fine. The actual story with the the snot monster, the bogeyman, that's all fine. The babies I guess a lot of people, that triggers their sort of uncanny valley reflexes. It's a strange sort of thing to sit and watch. You never quite get comfortable with the way they form the words, and there's a slight, I don't know, I find it a wee bit tricky is that when the doctor and Ruby first arrive in the baby farm and Eric first sort of rolls in there, he's talking in a way where, you know, he is talking like an adult in a child's body who just happens to be this, you know, this toddler in a stroller. but he's saying very scientifically intricate things, and he's talking in a very professional manner. And yet when they go back to the sort of control room there, the main control room, which something else I noticed today is just they have, I know they put a lot of effort into the sort of drawings on the walls and things, and I'm thinking, well, which of those children drew that? Did they get out of their prams to draw it? How did they get it up to that height? Anyway, that's the sort of silly stuff I can get distracted by. But yeah, when they go back to that control room, a lot of the children are talking in this very childlike way, you know, just very like the way Poppy talks, the way that child who sort of makes, I don't know, he's made that sort of intricate little wooden hand that pushes the button, and he's very proud of cleaning the pipes or whatever. But it's all, do you know what I mean? There's this sort of slight, from moment to moment, it can't seem to quite make up its mind, like how babyish these babies are, or how, you know, kind of like adults in children's bodies they are. And I'm not sure RTD ever quite came down on a consistent tone there. There's a moment where Eric goes off to face the bogeyman with, you know, armed with nothing more than a very blunt looking toy knife. And the first time I watched that, I thought, well, that's a wee bit silly. But, you know, he'd probably be a bit more intelligent than that, given what we've seen already. But actually, what I realized this time around was he's kind of, he's almost embodying some of the qualities of the doctor there, because the doctor would do exactly that. He'd take an intentionally useless weapon to go and give an enemy a stern talking to, you know, and then just throw the thing aside. So there are possibly more nuanced things in it than might first meet the eye. There's some very, like, you know, people who hated the burping wheelie bin must absolutely detest the I don't know how to put it, the spaceship's propulsion method at the end there, but that I can roll my eyes a wee bit at that, but also understand, like, it's just the fun and frothy one against which you foreground some introductory stuff, those key character beats where the doctor sort of gives Ruby the key and she agrees to travel with him, and she demonstrates that she understands the stakes but wants to go anyway, and it's an act of self-agency and all that. So all that stuff is done well, those sort of moments between the doctor and Ruby. And it's very much, you know, it's very much Russell T. Davies doing that thing he's traditionally done at the start of a season, which is, okay, let's go really extra frothy with this one. Make it almost intentionally thin stuff, and then just build from there. But
the Autons are a threat, but it's like you don't get much of a sense of them or much of an exploration of them. It's all about getting to know the Doctor and Rose in that episode. So yeah, maybe it's a similar approach here of like you say, a relatively thin story, but the focus is on getting to know these characters. Should we go on to our second episode, which is second episode in the season, The Devil's Chord? Which has a lot more going on. And I know you've got an interest in music, so I don't know if that, like, there was stuff that you picked up on in this one in particular, but yeah, what were your thoughts on The Devil's Chord?
I think it's the one that definitely feels most Disney of the out of the whole season. You know, there are other episodes where you go, yeah, I can see what the new budget has done for the show, but it doesn't feel intrinsically Disney-ish. But this one somehow did. I think something about the visual language of those you know, physical notes floating in the air and being swizzled around the, you know, Maestro and Maestro's own demeanor and stylings and everything, that could be you know, somebody ripped straight from a Disney cartoon, you know. It's a very impressive piece of work. I like it. I love the way it plays with music and that business of going into the title sequence with the you know, and all that, and then just gradually fading in the music, because here we are into this realm of you know, how would you describe it? Reality has been turned upside down, and there is, you know, here we now really begin the era of the overt fourth wall break. It bookends the thing. You know, we get it there, and we get it with the Doctor at the end going into a song and dance number, and even sort of giving a wink to the camera and talking about non-diegetic music at one stage. Incidentally, there was a thing there, just speaking of the sort of musical side of it. It was actually my girlfriend pointed this out to me, so I'm not going to take the credit for this one. She knows a lot more about music than I do, but she mentioned that 357, the room that Nanny was in the first, I think she said that 357 is some sort of triad, like an upper structure triad or something like that in music. You know, so if you take the bass note as being one, then your 357 gives you this sort of atonal chord, which sort of, I guess, nearly is its own little mini harbinger of what's to come. One other thing, by the way, sorry, not to keep going back to the earlier ones, but there's a moment in Space Babies where the Doctor picks up a spoon and he goes, "That's a great word, spoon." And then in this one, a spoon features again. And then what do we have in the finale? You know, a key moment with a spoon. So I think there are subtle little things. I'll tell you, one oddity that I remember sort of absolutely obsessing me at the time was, like, is that a deliberate thing about, okay, this appears to be Ruby's first trip back to the past? It's not necessarily, but it's strongly signaled that it is. And yet here she is saying that it's June in her timeline, June 2024.
Yeah, there's a bit of confusion about how much time has passed, because the line is very very quick, like almost like it was added in later or something. But it's like
very peculiar, because, you know, obviously six months not to have seen maybe I was reading too much into and assuming this was her first trip to the past, but it sort of felt like that. And then we get her first alien planet the following week, and you're thinking, well, that's even further on for her. So it's like minimum six to seven months she's seeing her first alien planet. What have they been doing all this time? And that began to make me, well, I know we're going to talk at the end about theories we had at the time, so I'm not leaning too heavily into that stuff right now, but it did get my mind ticking over on a few things. There's so much stuff in this. I love the fact we've got, I'll tell you what, actually, there was a clever thing in this. There's obviously the whole business about the bad music having having entirely replaced the good, and the disastrous consequences this will lead to, you know, nuclear war eventually, because people don't have that outlet for their emotions. But there's a really clever moment. I don't know if it's been mentioned elsewhere, and maybe it wasn't intentional, but it seemed to me that it was a clever thing. And I'm going to just bring in at this stage as a bit of an oblique but relevant reference, a Big Finish audio story called The Perpetual Bond, in which they managed to use a little bit of Beatles music, sort of, by not using the actual Beatles music. They use the opening, you know, the little French anthem bit of All You Need Is Love, and they managed to work that into the story in a really clever way. And they do something similar here, where they have, when the Doctor's racing around trying to see if everybody's affected by this virus of terrible music, he goes in at one stage and the orchestra is beginning to record what appears to be Three Blind Mice, but it's the same, it's these da, 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 and that's also the same little, to me, that was a way of sneaking in the opening notes of All You Need Is Love, because it's the same as Three Blind Mice. And I just thought, oh, that's clever. They've done that. They've got that. They've got Beatles music in without paying them a penny, even though it's not. You know what I mean? It's
well, the notes. You know, the notes at the end that they actually, you know, at the climax. Were those anything? Were those suggested?
I'm not sure. It would probably take a better expert on the Beatles than me. I must admit, I'm not steeped in all that, but could well be. Could well be. I did begin to wonder. You know, when the Doctor's having that conversation with Paul, it's really done, really well done, when they have the two separate sort of interviews, as it were, with Ruby talking to John and the Doctor talking to Paul, and he says, you know, sometimes late at night, I and it comes from deep within. I just have this little sequence of notes, and it goes. And I meant to go and play that on the piano and see if it if it sounded like anything. But I think that is ultimately just what they play, isn't it, in the corridor after the sort of music battle and everything. But yeah, I mean, this one, I know I'm going to kick myself after this for not having said like a ton more things, because it's packed with stuff. I think it's incredible. I think they really sell very, very well that moment where the Doctor, it's rare to see the Doctor absolutely like petrified, but you get it in this. You get it at the moment where he realizes that with each of these guys from the Pantheon, he's going to have, as he puts it, one trick once. And he is thinking on his feet more than he's ever had to in his life. And when he's used up his one trick, he has no idea what he's going to do next. And that to me feels incredibly tense. And that feels like we really are getting into realms where the Doctor's not quite been before. I mean, he feels out of his depth. You know, and Shuti plays that brilliantly. Like that moment where he's down in the cellar holding the sonic aloft and doing his one trick once, you know, and that whole sequence with the complete deafening of the world, you know, whatever he does there just cancels out all sound. And the way they direct that with the silently smashing bottle and the tuning fork being struck with no sound and all that, it's really, really effective.
Yeah, it's just making me think that, like, I did also like the fact that, so this era, right from the Star Beast onwards, has set up a lot of things like the Meeps boss and the Pantheon, but it hasn't strung those out too much. Like coming out of season one, we still have the mysteries or questions about Miss Fladen and a few other bits, but we got a follow-up on the Pantheon in the second episode in the season, and that it sort of comes back in the finale as well. And so I appreciated that yeah, there's loads of stuff teased, but it's not drawn out to the point where you lose interest in these things. The Beatles themselves, I think they were used really well, like just the right amount. You have those initial conversations, like you said, and then they come in to save the day at the end. This is purely like my sort of expectations looking at like how much they were featured in the promotion before the broadcast. But I think I had in my head that this was going to be much more of like along the lines of, those previous RTD celebrity historicals where you spend a lot of time with those characters that you know, we were going to meet all four of the Beatles and they were going to be like sort of main characters in this story. Whereas it works fine with them weaving in and out as they did. But that was one thing that I was sort of expecting going in that didn't pan out. What else? Was this the one where we had a reference to Susan? Was this when they're on the rooftop?
Yeah. Well, that's first of all, yeah, you're right. He starts talking about how he and his granddaughter lived just over there and how they'd just been through the great foggy winter of 1962 and all that. And Ruby's just standing there kind of agape at the fact that he's just, you know, dropped this fact. There's a really odd moment there actually where the Doctor, having said to her, you know, what happened to my granddaughter? Well, she probably got killed in the Time War. And then he laughs in a really strange way. Like, it's like, what's funny about that, Doctor? But I think when I look at it again, right, I kind of think, that's a really interesting acting choice, and it's sort of playing the truth of that, because, you know, you're either going to laugh or you're going to cry. It's like it's chaotic forces of your, you know, the emotions just spilling over in that. But he's sort of, I don't know, for Ruby's benefit, he laughs rather than cries, you know. But it's a curious one that, you know, it's a choice. Clearly it's a choice, but it definitely hits oddly, memorably, but oddly. We also have the billboard, you know, with the very early version of what is it, the carolers, who will eventually go on to be John Smith and the Common Men, and so there's there seem to be further little, I guess what will ultimately turn out to be red herrings, or are they? As far as Susan is concerned, certainly there were red herrings this season. I'll just mention, you know, because I know we need to move on in a moment, but like, in terms of the fourth wall stuff, it's not just what they do with the music and sort of, you know, those references to non-diegetic and those things. We also have, it's interesting that in this we get June Hudson playing a part, and we get Roger Lim's son, if I remember correctly, as the music instructor. And I don't know, this began to seed things in my head that either ultimately went nowhere or are yet still to go somewhere. Although I have, but anyway, we're going to touch on that soon, I know, but just in case I don't remember to list them all as bullet points at the end, these were some of the things that were coming into my awareness. I was thinking, are they doing some really clever stuff here? Or is it just stuff, you know, it's just like June Hudson wanted to be in it. So, you know, they weren't telegraphing anything intentionally, you know, there wasn't some complex meta plan. It was just, okay, June Hudson wanted to be involved, and Roger Lim's son happened to be an actor who, and it was nice to give him a part or whatever. But
And the episode's themed around music, so mm-hmm. sort of out of universe, it makes sense.
Also, just one final thing. Although it's set in 1963, there's a kind, and this is again where it maybe feels a wee bit more Disney's than some of the others. There's something about some of their choices. They've got, like, obviously the Abbey Road cover, and I understand why they've done that, but since that belongs a bit more to the late end of the 60s, but that, you know, it already has that feel out in the street with the Beetle Park and everything. And then they've got those very vibrantly colored costumes and the dance sequence at the end and everything. To be 1963, I mean, in my head 1963 isn't black and white anyway, but you know, it should feel, I don't know, somehow in my head it should feel a bit less colorful than that, but maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe that's just my my conditioning from having watched William Hartnell's era or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That was like a conscious choice about tone as well, and it obviously got a lot more colorful in the final scene, like so that they were probably, I think they were playing with the amount of color as well as things went through.
Oh, and the first overt mention of, although I know we had Susan Twist before, but this is the first time they really hammered on that notion of the twist at the end and what was going on. You know, it's like big neon signpost at that, if we hadn't spotted it already, sort of thing. So that's where things started to get very interesting in terms of what the heck is going on.
Yeah, and again, like adding fuel to theories about in and out of universe connections and like metatextual references, like referencing the actor's name. There's loads more we can say about this one, I'm sure. But should we go on to our third episode of the season, which is Boom? And this is Stephen Moffat coming back to Doctor Who, not as a showrunner, but again, like with the first RTD era, as a writer. I really enjoyed this one. I don't have loads and loads to say about it, though, but it was just like a really solid concept. I think Stephen Moffat talked about was pitching lots of ideas and being told by Russell T. Davies that, oh, you've done that, or you've done that, and then landing on this one. And I think it's a great sort of concept. It's realised really well. You get into it very quickly. It doesn't waste a lot of time getting into the setup. Is it just before the credits or just after that the Doctor steps on the landmine?
It's just before. It's like you see the lights sort of spin around, and then his eyes widen and then bang into the credits.
That's I think a really good example of like post 2005 Doctor Who using the pre-credits section to squeeze in a cliffhanger, and to get like a kind of like classic series cliffhanger in there, like something really exciting that ramps up the tension, and then you go away for a minute or two and rather than waiting a week to see the next episode, you see it play out after the credits. But I like those cold opens in the post 2005 series that have like a really strong, compelling lead in like that. What were your impressions of this one, either on first viewing or if that has changed with a rewatch?
First viewing and every subsequent viewing, I have just loved this thing. I just love the beautiful simplicity of that idea, and it builds entirely around this one moment, like this one sustained moment of tension. It's just, it's incredibly mesmerizing and yet agony to watch. And the Doctor sort of getting his zen on, as he puts it, is, he has to use every reserve available to him to stay as centered and as calm as he can, even while awful things are happening. You know, Ruby gets shot at one point. Which I love that moment where Ruby first comes out of the TARDIS and he's singing the Skyboat song. And he uses poetry and songs to sort of, just ground himself and pull himself out of the immediate now and into more abstract realms. But the whole time he's just right on this knife edge the whole way through. And I think I think as good as they have been up to that point, I think that was the strongest. It was a huge section of it is just almost like a two-hander for them. And the way she plays that scene where she hands over the urn, let's say the squash, the smelted body thing to him, and he's got to counterbalance himself, and she says, "No, I need a beat." So it comes back to her kind of musical side again. But this is one where, I mean, and Shitty gets over criticized, I think, at times for being the Doctor who cries all the time. But I think in this one,
it's the one where it's justified. It's like
most justified he's controlling. You know, he needs it. He actually needs it to balance himself out. Otherwise, he's literally going to explode. You know, and he's going to take half the planet with him. We get the introduction, of course, of Mundy Flynn, who, you know, clearly has, as we now know from the season two trailer, will go on to have a connective significance. How loose or intricate that connection is, we don't yet know, but there's an overtly signaled connection, that's very interesting, and she comes in and plays that part very, very well. So you can see absolutely why they looked at her and went, can she be given something else, can we have her more full time? And I just think it sounds a really obvious thing to say, but it's such a Moffat-y script. You kind of go, yeah, he has this down to fine art, you know. It's very polished. Some of the things. I don't know whether he has scripted it like this or whether Nshuti kind of workshopped it or whatever, but there's moments where this Doctor says certain things where you go, I can't imagine any other Doctor saying that. It's just, it's like that moment where he's like, do you get it, you know? Or I can't do this sort of patois or whatever, but at some point he refers to Faith Gill or whatever. You know, he's got these ways of putting things. You go, yeah, that's absolutely unique to his Doctor. And there's something about the rhythms of the speech in it, the tension of it, the way those moments play out, and he has paced it just beautifully. Like, you know, one thing layers on top of another, and then it hits a total crisis point. And of course, the old tablecloth trick at the end. It's a little bit the one sort of slight weakness of it, but I can forgive it this because obviously we're going to have to pull the cat out of the bag somehow. But you know, the dad sort of using his dad skills to subvert the system is, you know, it's veering into that sort of same territory as, you know, Daddy's Coming Home or whatever from Closing Time. That kind of there's a very fine line between an emotional payoff and something that's just pure cringe. Well, I think he stays just the right side of the line there. And the sort of kiss payoff and all that is,
I think, like, yeah, there's, I think what makes that work for me is that, like, a lot of this episode is quite brutal and grim, so it's kind of balancing things out to have a little bit of sort of sweet saccharine resolution, because yeah, like, there's some awful stuff that happens to people like leading up to that.
Yeah, there's a beautiful thing at the end, you know, where the doctor says snow isn't snow until it falls, and I just love the poetry of that. It sort of slightly echoes you know, Paul Cornell's thing about two snowflakes were the same, you know, long ago in an English spring, from the end of the Human Nature, the book version of Human Nature. I don't know whether Moffat has absorbed some of these little influences and then subconsciously or even consciously put them in, but yeah, and then he quotes Philip Larkin at the end as well. So that's nice. There's lots of lovely poetry. And at one stage the doctor's reciting this poem, you know, which is clearly to do with his own experiences, the stealing of the moon and the president's wife and all that stuff. And yeah, there's just some really just interesting stuff thrown in there while he's doing his whole stream of consciousness to stay ground. He's using everything he's got in his personal mental armory there, and it's fascinating to watch, and I think it works incredibly well. The other thing I mustn't forget to mention is this was Doctor Who's first use, wasn't it, of what do you call that piece of kit, the big wall?
I don't know if it was the thing I'm thinking of is the volume, but I don't know if this was exactly, it was the same kind of thing, like that sort of video wall. But yeah, I was thinking of exactly that, because I think Moffat's talked a lot in interviews about how, in theory, this was going to be, you know, the cheap episode of, like, very enclosed, you know, one set, limited cast. But he's also said this thing about, you know, there's no such thing as a cheap episode. And did we talk about this last time about Heaven Sent?
We did touch on it, yeah, we did.
You know, things like that, that, like, actually there's so much more work that needs to go into, like, coverage and editing and it's sort of, other things take the place of the things that you're saving money on. But yes, this was, and it comes back in the finale and other places, but that whole battlefield landscape was created on those screens.
Yeah. It seems to be one of those ones where different people's eyes seem to work a different ways for this. Cause for me, I was absolutely sold on it. Like, there was very, very few shots in that where I thought, yeah, that looks like a person stood in front of a screen, once or twice perhaps. But I mean, you know, like, if we can sit as fans as we do and watch, I don't know, like Planet of Giants, you know,
well, Underworld is the big
giant photographic blow up of yeah, exactly. That, you know, we can watch all these things, and then you see that, and it's streets ahead, and you go, God, well, I can forgive it—the odd moment of two dimensionality. And then there's a whole other sequences though, where stuff that you know must be happening just on a flat wall looks absolutely like it's, you know, in three dimensions. There's a sort of a phalanx of things that comes across the sky, and does the cleaning up of the battlefield and so on, and it looks for all the world like it's just, you know.
Yeah, that I noticed that rewatching it. That shot looked really good, and I think it's I think that they did a lot of this with the Meep and the Wrath Warriors in the previous specials, like doing as much as they can practically. So yes, they might be using this big screen, but they're still dressing and building enough of the set in the foreground with real stuff to sell it for me anyway. Like, it didn't take me out of it at all.
One thing I really like about this is the Doctor's music is on faith towards the end, because he sounds quite almost bitter and cynical about it. You know, he at one stage in his most stressed out moment describes faith as this sort of, you know, excuse for not having to actually think about things, you know. But then at the end he admits that as much as he doesn't like faith, he needs it. So there's a beautiful balance to that. And you know, he's a man of willful contradiction, the Doctor anyway. So I just kind of love the way that was done and the exact language used around it, and it's very respectful of believers and non-believers alike, I guess, in that respect. I think Moffat is quite deft and thoughtful in the way he approaches that kind of topic. And one final thing, you know, you mentioned obviously this was Moffat's pitch. Like, what if the Doctor does that thing he did in Genesis of the Daleks, but we just turn that into 50 minutes? Well, this was another thing that got my brain working around the whole, are they deliberately, you know, is this the show dropping yet another meta thing in? But anyway, I'll try and tie that all up in a bow at the end of it when we get to our what was your theory conversation here.
And so, and the stuff about religion, like Moffat had done a lot of that with the Church of the Silence, and in a way he's like doing more world building on top of that with Villengard and all of this. But yeah, like you said, I feel like he engages with it more directly in this episode than he has done in the past. Like, you know, lines like, you know, faith being an excuse for not thinking, and it feels like more like on the nose than it was in the past, where it was more dancing around it with just like a reference to the Church of the Silence or whatever. Although we did have like the Anglican soldiers, they're a returning element as well, aren't they? Because they popped up in previous stories.
Yeah, we had those guys in, Good Man Goes to War, and
was it in The Angels?
Oh yeah, of course. The first one that Matt shot, wasn't it? That one. So
yeah. Well, speaking of which, should we come on to 73 yards? I always get the number wrong.
It 73. Yeah. Sometimes I say 43 and I have no idea why. So it is 73.
And I believe this was the first thing that Mel Gibson shots, which is
incredible.
Pretty impressive given like how much is going on in this episode. It's a Doctor Light episode because they were working around Nshuti's availability for this first run. But I think this is the one where there's some really, really obvious connections with Years and Years, which is like one of the big things that that Russell T. Davis had done in between his two periods on Doctor Who. So you can really see a lot of that coming through. But it's also like, taking that necessity of, we don't have the actor who's our lead available for the whole run, but really, really turning it into a virtue and showcasing Ruby as a character, and using the absence of the Doctor as this really unsettling threat that like catapults into her into this nightmarish world. It's sort of like when I was rewatching it, like you can make a lot of connections to Turn Left, but it's done in like an almost more disturbingly real world way. It's about like very real like political positions, and there's like a really clear hint of sexual violence or some sort of abuse with one of the assistants in the sort of later half of the episode. But yeah, I thought there was loads going on in this one. So one thing that generated a lot of discussion was like the resolution. But before we get on to how it was all tied up, what were your overall impressions of this episode?
I really, really like this. There were complaints at the time that we'd had, you know, or that we were about to have a Doctor, you know, but this and an episode we'll talk about next week, the very next one, sort of put Doctor Light episodes back to back. But for me, not really a problem, because the following one, A Dot and Bubble, which we'll get to, I think, you know, I think it's a fan thing to be aware there was less shooting time for Nshuti than necessarily.
You feel their presence because they're always popping up in the,
that's right, that's
the messages.
Right. And so they get the most out of their shooting days that they did have. But in this one, I think just unavoidably, it was going to have to be Ruby carrying it all on her own shoulders. They turned that into very much a feature, not a bug. It's very, we talked about, you know, how last week about when our last sort of episode we discussed this, we were talking about how our expectations of what Russell T. Davis would bring back into the show from how he'd evolved as a writer. And in the meantime, of course, he'd done years and years, and we get a very, I think this is, maybe you already said this, apologies if you did just a moment ago, you know, I think it's the most years and years influence feeling episode of the season. And there's even a wee touch of something like The Second Coming there, because there's a bit where Roger Ap William is kind of laughing malevolently, and you see almost like those little white dots in his eyes. It's like that kind of demonic kind of feel to him, and you see that he is the absolute monster that that he is implied to be. There is something deeply unsettling about it, and yet it's kind of there's a warmth to it as well. It's a Ruby's story. The bit I particularly love is that montage you get in the middle where they've chosen an old Libby Siffre song, and they just play out her sort of coming to terms with you know, being haunted by this phenomenon, and almost in the end making peace with it, or, you know, it becomes an old friend, and then she realizes, you know, it's at some point she has this revelation of what it all means, and she goes, you know, come on, we have work to do, and she's talking to the apparition, and
but she looks back at the camera at that point, so that's like another. I only really noticed that this time, how she looks right at the camera in that moment of we've got work to do, and again, right. That's like a bit of a fourth wall moment.
I know it is a slight. It's one of those things we're slightly inclined to roll our eyes at, where we say, okay, how many years is Ruby supposed to have aged by now? And you know, does it, I guess there's only two ways you can really do that. You either add prosthetics to somebody, which is never an entirely successful venture, or you do what they did here, sort of style her hair differently.
Give us some big glasses.
But on the other hand, it is the future. So, like, you know, you see, you know, when she's looking outside her window there with a glass of wine toasting her sort of frenemy there, you know, there are little nice touches like holograms, like Blade Runner type of holograms going on in the sky off in the background. And you think, well, you know, maybe the average, you know, 40-year-old does look like a 20-year-old by that point, because there's technological advances.
Things.
So, you know, there's things like that. But yeah, I mean, I didn't get too distracted by stuff like that, because I think the story itself is so compelling. I think it's really effectively written. And it's the one where Russell T. Davis sort of manages to get under your skin. Like, there's a whole, you know, it's sort of like darkly comedic, you know, that whole business with the Welsh pub and the punters all playing a collective practical joke on Ruby, because they want to get back at the English for being so maybe stereotyping and how they view these Welsh villagers, you know. So that stuff's kind of scary and fun at the same time. But yeah, I just love the feel of it. I love that moment. There's something about the exterior shots having been filmed in December, as I believe it was, and just what that adds in terms of the quality of the light and the snow gently coming down. And I don't know if that on that occasion was real snow or Ruby snow, but we have it nonetheless. And then Susan Twist's appearance in that one is a really interesting one, because it's her at her most benevolent, I guess, and friendly. And you start to think, like, what is going on here? Like, you know, why is she so different each time?
And this is the point at which, like, she'd made several appearances, and it was like, okay, no, they haven't just reused an actor that they liked. There's some significance to this.
Yeah. So, but the way that one wraps up with the return to the, you know, the book ending at the end. I love that little payoff where he says, "Oh yeah, you never mentioned the third time you were here in Wales," and she just sort of says, "Oh, well, I suppose it must have been." No, which is just the last little lingering awareness of the reset timeline.
And on rewatching it, it seems really clear to me on a rewatch that is meant to be her. But I remember watching it the first time around, and it felt more ambiguous or vague, or there was some wriggle room of, is that her, or is you know, the woman that she's seeing some other sort of external entity that's jumping back in time. But
yeah,
yeah, looking at the way that the voiceover goes over the view of her hands moving, it's older Ruby telling her younger self how to avoid this timeline.
It's also one of those, in Doctor Who terms, only occasional episodes where really there's just a sort of unresolved ambiguity as to what the whole causation of it was, really. Like, I mean, it's
yeah, the fairy circle is never
come to be. Russell, I remember I was driving some people absolutely bonkers, and there was a sort of quite a divide between the people who said, look, it doesn't need to be explained, and those who were saying, no, it absolutely does, you know. But I kind of tend to sit on the side of, look, if it's intentional and well done ambiguity, and half the power is in its mysteriousness, then just, you know, let take it for what it is and enjoy the atmosphere and the journey. And
that's the other thing that's not explained, is how her older self can loop back, or and when we get to the finale, it suggests that there's something to do with the TARDIS because of that distance of the perception filter. But yeah, how does she actually even manage to go back and communicate with herself?
Talking of the TARDIS, I remember one of the things I was thinking when I first watched it. I don't really think this now, but when I first watched it, it genuinely was in my mind that, you know, when she first goes to the TARDIS there, you know, he's disappeared, and she checks, you know, around the back, and then she goes to the front doors, and she's kind of she goes back a day later and she's talking to him through the doors and going, look, maybe this is something you just sometimes do and you're in there, and but I would really love to travel with you again, and if you ever want to do that, I'm here, you know. But it occurred to me that he could very well be on the other side of those doors, and for some reason he just needs to. It is one possible explanation, actually, that he did stay in there, and that having perceived something that needed to loop and couldn't interfere in, he did what he needed to do, and maybe did nudge things with the TARDIS from within or whatever. I don't know. It's I lean towards that not being the case now, but I like the fact that it's at least one of a number of possibilities. You know, and on the face of, you know, you could take it as quite a cruel thing, but maybe just one of those needful things that the Doctor just has to do to get things back on.
I feel like he would have come, especially this Doctor, I feel like he would have come clean after it was all resolved and
yeah, possibly revealed it. Then as he will later go on to say, you know, there are no unkind ways to do the necessary to save someone or to save a situation. So I don't know. One image I really love is just the TARDIS and that cliff top. Just I know I talked about this last week, but when David Tennant had his whole speech about what happens to the TARDIS when it goes off, and you know, during its when the HADS is triggered and it goes off somewhere, and then centuries come and go and civilizations rise and fall around, and we get that sort of in miniature here with the TARDIS just sitting there for decades, and it becomes this something really moving about the fact that people come and leave flowers there, and nobody really knows why, but there's probably this just residual gratitude in people for something that they intuitively recognize to be you know, associated with it's the iconography of the guy who saved the universe more times than anyone can count, and they feel it more than know it, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of poetry and atmosphere in it, and I could watch it over and over and over again, and just
so one of our like wrap up questions was like which of these five episodes is your favorite, and I really struggle to answer that question, and not to be too negative, but it's like Space Babies is the weak one for me, or the least good. It's like okay. I'd then place like Church on Ruby Road is like that solid intro, but these last three, I really like all three of them: Devil's Chord, Boom, and 73 Yards, and I feel like they're all really good and interesting in different ways. So I really struggle to rank those last three, but do you have a favorite that jumps out of
five? I would say it's similar to yourself. I would say Space Babies, yeah, I couldn't argue with you that that's the weakest, as much as I seem to enjoy it more than some other people, and clearly you do as well. And then I would put Church next, and then The Devil's Chord would be like a strong 8 out of 10 for me. But those two, Boom and 73 Yards, sit like shoulder to shoulder as just like certainly out of the first half of this season, the strongest ones. Like, they're 9 or 10 out of 10 for me. Those they just hold up to repeated viewing time and time again, and I'm just in for the ride every time. You know, I'm just mesmerized.
Yeah, and given so we're both a bit mixed on Space Babies, but maybe see like some value in it, like more than others might. But one other question we had is like, if there was someone new to Doctor Who or who hadn't watched it in ages, where would you tell them to start with this new era? Would it be the Star Beast or Church on Ruby Road, or would it be Space Babies?
I think I'd go with Church. I think I'd have to go with Church on Ruby Road on that one. I just think it's the cleanest kind of break. And Space Babies is, I'm not saying it's too weak an episode to start with, but I wouldn't want... if it was a betting man, I wouldn't fancy my chances of getting somebody to watch a further episode after Space Babies. You know, they might, you know, depend, because everybody's got radically different tastes of what they like out of their Doctor Who. And you could show everybody's had the experience of, well, not everybody, but a number of fans like will have tried over the years to sort of get some knotwee into watching Doctor Who. And you choose, you know, you think, oh, City of Death, surely that's the one. You know, you show them City of Death and they just... 5 minutes in, it's like, I can't, you know, and you're going, are you kidding me? This is like one of the best things ever made. But maybe I could have shown them Paradise Towers and they'd have been like, right, give me everything else. I don't know. It's a strange alchemy, that whole business. But yes, Church to me feels like the one where you go, right, you're not being presented with, as it were, a choice of doctors, you know, because somebody watching the Tenant ones and then sort of seeing Shitty come in, it's like maybe they were just warming up to Tenant, you know, somebody new, and then they're given this whole other doctor and they're like, oh, but I want to know more about this other guy, and I know he's got older episodes, so maybe they're kind of going back towards that instead of forwards towards Shitty. Whereas with Church and Ruby Road, it's like you're giving him like fresh out of the box and kind of firing on all cylinders and showing a lot of range.
Yeah, I think I agree that Church is like the most solid introduction. The only wrinkle is that there are all these little bits that are set up in those Tenant specials, and one of the big ones is the weakening of the walls of reality with salt, and it's not essential, but maybe the ideal order is like non-linear, is to start with Church on Ruby Road and go forward through that first season. And then if you're really enjoying it and waiting for the next season, go back and like almost as a prequel, fill in those Tenant specials, and then go back to the classic series if you want. But Church on Ruby Road is that sort of, it's not overly laden with the history of the show, unlike when we got onto the finale, which is sort of the opposite.
Because a new fan starting there, and I mean a completely new fan starting there, has no awareness that Doctor Who has tended not to lean quite so far into the supernatural before, it's not a problem for them.
It doesn't seem out of place. The universe
presented to them as this, yeah. You know, and then they can discover if they dip back in that it used to be a bit more.
So one last question before we wrap up, and it's that one that we've been sort of skirting around is. So when we were watching this first time round, we were halfway through the season. We'd had these new little, new choices about inclusion of music and playing around with lines about it being non-diegetic and people looking to camera. And what were the theories that were sort of in the air about where this was all going?
I know that my own personal theory, which I think, you know, substantially came just from my own madness, but I think I picked up bits and pieces from you know, discussions on Gallifrey Brace and so on as well, and assimilated bits of that in a magpie fashion into this great unified theory. And basically what I was thinking was that the show was trying to build up was seeding in the whole way along this notion that was going to resolve in a blindsiding to the casual viewer anyway, revelation that Doctor Who actually is a TV program, and the Doctor doesn't know that he's been in this TV program, which of course would not ultimately turn out to be the case, but that's what he would be set up at the end of season to believe. And I even had this vision that like Stephen Powell was going to walk in and sort of and you'd pull back and there'd be cameras sitting there, and it's just mad stuff like that,
It's not
in Bad Wolf Studios,
it's not unprecedented. There's Deep Space Nine and Buffy, and I'm sure loads of other shows have done that, maybe not as a series long arc, but a lot of these sci-fi shows have had that one episode that sort of plays with the idea of, what if this is all in our lead character's head, or what if this is a show that they've written and it's sort of become their imagined reality. And so yeah, it's not completely out there.
I'll tell you what the real kind of, I know Russell T. This is where it particularly took hold of my head as a very plausible possibility, and it's my own fault that it ran. The theory absolutely ran away with me, and I got a bit too fixated and turned every non-relevant detail into something of significance. I could start listing them all, but it would take all night. But I know Russell T. Davis is a big fan of, or at least a big advocate of Big Finish, and I know he's listened to a lot of Big Finish, and it wouldn't necessarily be just Doctor Who stuff. And there's a story, it's a Sapphire and Steel story called The Mystery of the Missing Hour. And I wondered, had he heard that, or had he taken that kind of idea? Well, I guess this is a spoiler for anyone who hasn't heard that, but then the chances of anybody who's listening to this wanting to hear it is probably relatively slim, or being able to get hold of it at this point. But it's a story in which the twist is revealed to be that the people in this audio drama are actually in, they're trapped in a recording studio acting out these parts, and they don't even know it, so they've become their sort of fictional counterparts, but they're also doing things like they begin to realize as they gain awareness of the fact that, for instance, actors are doubling up and things like that, and then no two people can talk at this, two particular characters can't talk at the same time because it's the same actor, and so and all this sort of starts to break down their conditioning, so they begin to realize where they are and what's been going on, and so I tried to look for the sort of television equivalents in this season, because I thought they were starting to see that in, with
the non-diegetic line.
Yeah, non-diegetic was one example. I mean, just to use a totally random one, at the end of Boom, there's a moment where the Doctor is standing at the TARDIS door talking about, snow isn't snow until it falls and so on. And he's rummaging around in his pockets looking distracted, and he's clearly looking for the key, the TARDIS key. And but he looks sort of distracted by a thought, like something's not quite adding up for him. And then Ruby just hands him the TARDIS key from her pocket to him, and he goes and unlocks the door. And in that moment, completely incorrectly as it turns out, I was going, that's the one that sells it for me. I think I'm onto something with this theory, because what they've done there is they've very, very cleverly given you a moment where a prop that's shared, a single prop that's shared between two actors is shown, literally been handed across on camera. And against a sort of, you could argue, a slightly intentionally fakey looking background with the volume or whatever you want to call that thing. I think it was still really well done. But if you were the sort of person who thought it maybe looked a bit set-like, you could say this is TV telegraphing itself as TV. Now, obviously, the way the series ultimately went, I was initially very disappointed because none of this theory got blown out of the water completely down the line. But or it's still to play out in a later season. But I don't think that that's where we're going anymore.
Let's definitely come back to that in our next episode, because yes, it was blown out of the water by the end of season one, but if you look at the season two trailer, there's like fresh stuff that you could use as fuel to think about the walls of reality being
being no, I've learned my lesson. I'm not quite, it's just going to turn out to be that the Candyman's coming back or something.
No, I'm thinking in particular of that the cartoon character that's featured in the new trailer in season two, and like, you know, there's something literally there about like a fictional character jumping out of a screen. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see soon. At the time of recording, just a few weeks off. From the new series. Okay, all right. Well, we'll leave it there. We've got the second half of the series to jump into, and like I said, when we cover that second half and Joy to the World, which I think will be a nice, which is one that, you know, you were really positive on, and I liked a lot as well, and that'll be a nice nice one to end on. And then we'll talk a little bit about
all my homework this time instead of off it with one of them.
And then we'll do a little bit of speculation and looking forward to season two as well, and thoughts, and then let's see whether our predictions for season two pan out or not over the next couple of months. So thanks very much for joining me again for this look back at the middle part of RTD2 so far.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
And yes, we will see you soon for part 3.